Our next speaker is Professor Robert Dienstein, who's a professor of law, director of the clinical program, and director of the Disability Rights Law Clinic at American University Washington College of Law, where he's been teaching since 1983. He was an attorney for 5 years at the Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division, Special Litigation Section. From 1988 to 96, Professor Dienstein has directed the law school's nationally recognized clinical law program. And from 97 to 2004, he was an associate dean for academic affairs at the law school. Professor Dienstein has is a signatory on the Montreal Declaration on Intellectual Disabilities and the legal opinion on Article 12. He has an AB degree from Cornell and a JD from Yale. Having said that, please, Dr. Professor Dienstein.
Good morning. We can see who the late breakfasters are as you've sort of come in, but we're happy you're here. And I guess I should say orally, I have no conflicts to disclose. This is the difference between presenting at a law teaching or legal convention and a public health one, which was, we probably have conflicts all the time, but it would never occur to us to actually disclose them. Today is an interesting day to be talking about human rights of people with disabilities. As you may know, this afternoon the Senate Foreign Relations Committee will be taking up for the second time the possibility of ratification of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, or the CRPD. And I'll keep using CRPD because otherwise my entire session would be taken up just saying those words. You may remember that last December, the convention came up for ratification and was rejected by the Senate. There were, I think, all the Democrats voted for it, but they did not have enough Republican votes. You need 67 votes to ratify a convention. So it's now been resubmitted. At the time, the convention, the opposition, to the extent you could identify reasons for the opposition, as opposed to the kind of stamping one's feet kind of reasons, were that, first of all, a general concern that why should we ever agree to anything from any other entity in the world at all, kind of an anti-treaty perspective, particularly when it's a human rights treaty. Most human rights treaties we have not actually ratified, as it turns out. We are, by the way, one of only two countries in the world that's not ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the other country being Somalia. If you just saw Captain Phillips, you know that it's not really functioning so much as a country these days, so we're in really not the greatest company on that. But there were some concerns that somehow the convention would ban or make it more difficult homeschooling on the part of parents who wish to school their children at home, possibly that it will enshrine abortion rights. Neither of these things appears to be true. But we'll see what happens. So at 2:30 today, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee will hold the first of two hearings on the convention. I think there's actually some optimism that the convention will be ratified. If it is ratified, we will join 138 other countries that have ratified the convention, which, by the way, came into effect in May 2008. And 158 countries, including us, who have actually signed the convention. And I think the latest count of countries is something like 195 or something like that. So almost every country in the world, in a really remarkably fast way, at least in terms of UN time, has actually ratified the convention. Most recently, a country, and perhaps you've heard of it, I hadn't, Kiribati, which in September 27th ratified the convention. There's also something called the Optional Protocol, which allows the bringing of individual complaints. That's not something the U.S. certainly will ratify at all. But even that has 92 countries have signed and 78 have ratified. So within the human rights world, the CRPD is a big deal. It was agreed to at the General Assembly level in 2006 and again was open for signature and was ratified and therefore went into effect in 2008. What I'm going to talk about is the way in which the convention shifts the paradigm shift of the convention toward people with disabilities, and in particular, its enshrinement of a kind of human rights social model of disability, as opposed to more traditional models of disability. The human rights or social model of disability looks at disability as the consequence of an interaction between an individual and his or her environment. That environment can be the physical environment. You know, if you use a wheelchair, can you get into a building that has only stairs? That kind of thing. But it's also an attitudinal environment. So some of what we heard in the first presentation about stigma is very much something that relates to issues of disability. So the impairment piece of disability, which itself is sometimes socially constructed, is in some ways less important than the societal response to disability, which is what makes an impairment disabling more or less to a degree. And the convention really adopts this principle and adopts, furthermore, a principle that might be called the equality or the non-discrimination principle. It doesn't really create new rights for people with disabilities, but what it says is that those rights that do exist in society must be applied to people with disabilities in a non-discriminatory way. The Disability Convention doesn't say you can't charge people with disabilities with a crime, for example, but it does say you can't charge them with particular crimes if you wouldn't have otherwise charged people who don't have disabilities. Now, it's easier to say these things in the abstract sometimes than it is to implement, and I'm going to talk about some of the ways in which this can be challenging. But one of the ways that I think it plays out is the recognition of the importance of rights such as autonomy, self-determination, dignity, respect for one's choices in life. These are things we take for granted as adults, both for ourselves and for other adults we know, but for whom these are rights that people with disabilities have often been denied, sometimes only on the basis of just a diagnostic category, sometimes on the basis of behavior that is seen as challenging in some ways. But the convention pretty much says none of these things really count. You cannot take people's rights away just because they happen to have the label of a particular psychiatric diagnosis. And that emphasis on choice and support for choice, and I'll come back to the concept of support in a minute, is really critical to understanding the ways in which this convention truly can be revolutionary in important ways. I come at these issues both from an academic perspective. It's been my focus for many years, also a kind of more practical perspective as a lawyer who represents people with disabilities, and from a personal perspective. I have a younger sister with an intellectual disability who lives in a group home in upstate New York. I see her pretty often. We speak lots of times a week. And in fact, I'm actually her guardian, although I'll talk a little bit about how guardianship is kind of problematic under the new regime. But in talking with her many times about choices, both big and small, I've learned the challenge of actually trying to assist her with making choices, and also the recognition that people's will and preference will out in its way. So I'll give you one example of this. My sister, left to her own devices, would probably drink nothing but diet soda all day long. And so we talk a lot about how that's not the wisest choice. And she's also had these discussions with the staff people she works with, and they try to kind of come up with rules. And because she has an intellectual disability, she's looking for rules that she can understand and then apply. And her level of thinking about this is pretty concrete. So we came to a conclusion that it was fine to have a soda a day, but probably not more than one, just as a way to manage it. And she claimed to be okay with that. And so then we talked about how do you actually translate that into, you know, three meals a day. Well, we clearly ruled out breakfast as a place for soda, although any of you having soda this morning, I mean no disrespect. But then we talked about, well, you could have it at lunch or at dinner, and said, you know, if you have it at lunch, that means you can't have it at dinner. Yeah, I get that. Or if you want to wait, you don't have it at lunch, then you can have it at dinner. So this was absolutely, I'm yes, that's okay, that's great, she's very excited. So I went up to visit her on one particular trip, and we went out to the same diner that she always likes to go to, although she always pretends as if it's a choice. So where would you like to go? Well, I don't know. How about the Liberty Diner? So we always go to the Liberty Diner. And we sat down, and she'd had a soda that day for lunch. So as we sat down, I said, okay, so what are you going to have for dinner? She knew that what she was supposed to say was, well, I'm going to have water because, you know, I had my soda. Yeah, okay. So, of course, that also meant that I couldn't have soda, which was fine, but I wasn't going to rub it in, right? So I was going to have water. She was going to want it. Everything was all set. We're, you know, plan to have a very pleasant dinner. And the waitress comes over and looks at me, you know, says, what would you like to drink? And, you know, I'd like water. And she turns to my sister and says, so do you want soda? And my sister's eyes lit up like she had just been released from some shackles. She said, yes, I want soda. There you go, choice, right? And of course it didn't matter, right? I wasn't going to say, oh, you can't have the soda. It was so delightful to watch her get so excited about this. The point is that And what is the point? The point is about this story, which I tell just to tell the story, of course, is that the recognition of the dignity and the choice making that people make, and to understand how critical that is to who we are as human beings and how much we take for granted. Again, choices about either very important things, where you're going to live, who you're going to marry, if you're going to marry, how to open up, you know, how to deal with money transactions is certainly where we get the focus. But it also relates to very small things. And part of the experience of being with a person with a disability in many cases, especially psychosocial or intellectual disabilities, is not having those choices recognized, or people telling you what you should do, often coming out of a very good place, often wanting to protect or to help people, but not always respecting what people really want to do. And by the same token, I want to be clear, I'm not saying that any choice that a person with a disability wants to make has to automatically be followed. The idea is to engage them in a conversation, in a process, that respects them as individuals who have the right to make choices and to either be influenced or to reject influence, just the way we do, right? Now, how does this play out within the convention? There are many individual provisions of the convention. The most important one from my perspective, I think, and I think it's borne out in terms of the first efforts to interpret the convention, is Article 12. Article 12 of the convention is entitled Equal Recognition Before the Law. And it's a very simple title. It says that every individual has legal capacity, and furthermore, that everybody has the capacity to act, though some may need support in doing so. Now, what does that mean? What has been taken to mean has been that the fact that we have systems in place in every country in the world called guardianship or trusteeship or conservatorship, in which decision-making is taken out of the hands of the individual and put in the hands of someone else to exercise on their behalf, while sometimes protecting their interests, many times protecting their interests, come at a very high cost. And the cost is to deny the civil status of adults, basically to say you are a non-person for purposes of living in society because somebody else has to validate the decisions you want to make. So if you want to open up a bank account and you're under guardianship, the banker is not going to accept your signature as valid unless there is a guardian who signs for you. And we could go on and on about the many problems with guardianship, and I certainly don't have time to do that, but simply to say that even when it's functioning the way it should, even when it provides the protection it's supposed to, and there are many examples where it doesn't do that, where people are abused in guardianship, it, again, comes at too high a price. So what is the alternative to it? The alternative is something called supported decision-making, which actually is a concept that has gotten some resonance in various provinces of Canada, most prominently British Columbia, in Sweden, in Germany, parts of Australia. And this concept says that we don't need to take away people's decision-making rights through a formal process before a court or otherwise, but we need to support them in decisions that they make and provide that support in the various ways that we might that we can, some of which can be done naturally, right? So it can be a family member, it can be a friend, it can be a colleague who doesn't have to be paid to be a supporter, but can simply be, you know, a trusted friend. We know that many people with disabilities don't have such people in their lives, especially if they've come out of institutions where the family connections were severed, if they existed at all. And for those people, you may have to bring in people to understand what those rights are. Now, for some, the nature of support is pretty straightforward. It might be just, as with my sister, working with her through a decision-making process. For others, it may be communicating with people who don't communicate verbally, but communicate through actions or inactions that can be interpreted by people who know them. And, of course, part of the challenge here is to spend the time with somebody so that you know how they want to express themselves. And in any case, we want to both support them but not substitute for them. So the idea is that the person remains the primary decision maker in his or her life simply with the help of others. And I always look at this in contrast to what we imagine the way people without disabilities function. So sometimes the criticism of this kind of regime is, well, but people who need support, that means they can't make decisions. This isn't, you know, they're too helpless. And I say, well, think about your own decisions in your own life. If they're really important decisions, how many of them would you make in isolation from anybody else? The trick is determining who you want to hear from and how you want to hear from them, right? That's what makes the difference between buying the house that your mother-in-law says you shouldn't buy or not buying that house and deciding whether to validate that and whether you want your marriage to continue. So these are important kinds of concepts, and the United States is slowly, I would say, getting to recognize this. And my last thing I'll say about that is We just had a case in Virginia, a case regarding a woman named Jenny Hatch, and I testified as an expert witness in that case. This was a woman who was 29 years old, a woman with Down syndrome, whose mother and stepfather wanted to be her guardians. They didn't think she was making wise choices. Among other things, she had a serious bike accident, and she delayed a little bit before approving the operation that was needed. And they took this delay as an indication that she was not a decision maker to be trusted. So they sought guardianship. Now, normally in Virginia and in many states, that would be a pretty straightforward affair. She'd have a lawyer appointed. The lawyer might go through the motions in arguing that she shouldn't have a guardian, but everybody would pretty much say, yes, this is what ought to happen. Except that Jenny was a young woman who didn't want to go this route. She had major conflicts with her parents or with her mother and stepfather. She didn't want to be told how to live. She was a very active individual. She was on Facebook. She had her own cell phone. She was very much a person in the community. And she resented this. So she got in touch with some folks at an organization called the Quality Trust for Individuals with Disabilities in Washington. My disclosure, I'm chair of their board. One thing led to another, and we presented evidence on her behalf in which she challenged the idea of having a guardian and instead argued for the ability to engage in supported decision making through Medicaid waiver and other supports that would help her be able to live in the community with the assistance of others if she wanted it. The judge, very traditional, I think didn't see this one coming, wasn't so interested in seeing it coming, but had to decide the case, ultimately concluded that even though he didn't think that Jenny was yet ready to engage in supported decision-making, which I don't think is necessarily right, but that was his conclusion, that he was not going to appoint the mother and the stepfather as guardians. He appointed instead a couple that Jenny had befriended and with whom she had worked, but for a one-year period only, at which point the guardianship would end, for only limited purposes to help her in health care and I think one other set of decisions, and crucially, to help prepare her to benefit from supported decision-making as opposed to the substituted regime. So this judge is one of only about two judges in the United States who have so far recognized supported decision-making. I think I may be reading the tea leaves wrong, but I think this is something that's going to take off in lots of ways, either as a less restrictive alternative to guardianship in existing guardianship laws, or through separate legal regimes that recognize supported decision-making. Now, my last point about that will be the following. In setting up supported decision-making, it's important to make sure the supporter is not taking advantage of the person being supported. That can happen in that regime just as it can in guardianship. It's also important that people out in the world who interact with people understand who the supporter is so that they can legitimately protect themselves from a later charge that, well, you took advantage of somebody with a disability. You should not have let them open up this bank account. You should not have engaged in this transaction. So there are very important details to work out about this. But the important point is that the kinds of rights that Article 12 enshrines and that other articles in the Convention enshrine as well really go to these very basic concepts of equality and dignity. Considering the ratification of the treaty, many people in support of the treaty said, you know, in many ways, the treaty really doesn't do anything more internationally than what we already have in the United States with the Americans with Disabilities Act, Section 504, the Rehabilitation Act, and others. I think that goes too far. There are many things in the treaty that at the national level would be changes. But in many respects, the United States has been a beacon in disability rights throughout the world, and this is a really major limitation on that role to not have ratified the convention. So the hope is, you know, knock on whatever this is, that the hearings will go well today, and next week there's a second set of hearings, that this time the Senate, having been shamed by the Colbert Report and the Daily Report into why it failed to ratify back in December, will do so this time. And then, you know, a year from now we'll be talking about how does the U.S. actually try to implement this treaty. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Our next speaker, any clarifying questions? Well, if not, we'll save the questions for later. Our next speaker is Dr. Marilyn McEwen from College of Nursing from Arizona School of Public Health. Dr. McEwen's program of research focuses on decreasing health disparities among persons of Mexican origin who reside in the Arizona Sonora border region. I always call it Sonoma, like a Sonoma-Williams. too many cakes. For the past 22 years, she has developed unique clinical experiences for health sciences students in interprofessional rural health training and has conducted studies with diverse populations. In this context, she has examined factors that contribute to asymmetrical power relations that underpin human rights violations in this unique geopolitical region. Welcome.
Good morning. Still early, so I applaud you for being here. Human rights violations targeted against Mexican border crossers have become endemic in the Arizona-Sonora-Mexico border region. There is an ever-present tension between those in the position of power to regulate the entry and stay of undocumented border crossers in Arizona and the international human rights laws that ensure that practices do not place border crossers at an increased risk of human rights abuses. This is the obligatory slide. I have nothing to disclose. This is a map of the U.S.-Mexico border region. It's composed of 4 states on the U.S. side and 10 states on the Mexico side. International boundaries have the same basic function everywhere in the world, to delimit one nation from another and to control the movement of people and goods from one side of the boundary to the other. The 2,000 miles that we border with Mexico is one of the most dynamic regions in the world. This border area is defined as 62.5 miles or 100 kilometers north and south of the international line. The border is approximately half the length of the U.S.-Canadian border and represents the distance from Washington, D.C. to Phoenix, Arizona in terms of direct miles. Approaching 80 million residents, the population in these 10 border states surpasses the population of France or the United Kingdom. In the last decade, the U.S. has relied heavily on enforcement-only approaches. Has relied heavily on enforcement-only approaches to address migration using deterrence-based border security strategies to control its borders. The U.S. government has expanded the powers of federal authorities by creating constitution-light or constitution-free zones within 100 miles of land and sea, and has increasingly criminalized unauthorized migration by expanding criminal prosecution of individuals who violate federal immigration laws. The exceptionalized space and criminalization of migration has served to justify the militarization of the U.S. border and to promulgate border security policies and practices that lead to civil and human rights abuses, including the deaths of more than 5,600 unauthorized border crossers. The reasons for migration are varied and complex. In this slide on the left side, you can see these are 3 themes from a study that I conducted with 2 colleagues who were our emergency department physicians. We were interested in understanding male border crossers from Mexico across the Sonoran Desert. We were interested in understanding their perception of risk in crossing that very dangerous zone. And of course, what we see is it's all driven by the family. It's one man said to me, it's not about buying diapers. It's not about buying Pampers. It's about having food because our families, our communities as a whole are starving. Migrants who lack official authorization, undocumented migrants, are a vulnerable and marginalized population. They're oftentimes uninformed and or misinformed of the risks associated with being funneled thanks to Operation Hold the Line and Operation Gatekeeper of the 90s, being funneled into the hostile terrain of the Sonoran Desert during migration from Mexico into Arizona. Once they have settled in the U.S., they are at risk of discriminatory treatment, and in the Arizona-Sonora border region, they are being targeted for racial profiling by state and local law enforcement officials. Customs and Border Patrol Protection is the main agency within the Department of Homeland Security for immigration enforcement along the border, and Border Patrol is a sub-agency of Customs Border and Protection Agency. This report, this two-year study by Amnesty International, found border communities are disproportionately affected by a variety of immigration control measures, leading to violations in the region. In terms of local policies and practices, often promote structural violence. One is in terms of geographic segregation. And here we have indigenous peoples. We have multiple tribes that span both the U.S. and Mexico that are across the international boundary. Indigenous people, the territories and cultural communities span the border. They may need to cross the border frequently in order to maintain contact with their families, members of their community, or visit cultural and religious sites on either side of the border. Failure to adequately recognize and protect the border crossing rights of these communities has left them at risk of discrimination and abuse during border crossings and in dealing with Border Patrol agents on tribal lands. In terms of mixed immigration status families, increasingly Arizona state law and local policies are creating barriers to or discouraging immigrants from accessing their rights to education and health. Children of undocumented immigrants who are U.S. citizens and eligible for government-funded medical insurance and food benefits are often unable to access these resources because the application process requires disclosure of their parents' immigration status, placing the entire family at risk of deportation or separation. Then, of course, we've got unequal access to health care resources. We all know that in the Affordable Care Act, undocumented persons are unaccounted for. In terms of structural violence, we've got unemployment issues. In Arizona, we have increased restrictions now on day laborers. They cannot congregate on at intersections as they used to. And of course, we see lower education and health literacy among this population, and we all know about the DREAM Act and the DREAMers. Exemplars of policies and practices. Unfortunately, our Arizona governor signed into law in 2010 SB 1070. The law requires police officers, when practical, to detain people they suspect are in the country without authorization and to pull them over to verify their status. While immigration enforcement in the U.S. is exclusively a federal responsibility, recent legislation enacted or proposed in the Southwest specifically targets these immigrants and places them at increased risk of discrimination. For example, state and local law enforcement officers inquire about immigration status based on reasonable suspicion of being undocumented. We've been termed the "show me your papers" state. U.S. legislation makes provision for undocumented immigrants who are victims of crimes such as people trafficking or domestic violence, that they be given temporary legal immigration status and to pursue remedies against the perpetrator of the crime. However, it's common that people in the Arizona-Sonora border region, they're reluctant. They're reluctant to interact with the law. They're frightened of oftentimes of the law enforcement authorities. They fear deportation. They fear the loss of the custody of their children. The fact that local law enforcement is used to implement federal immigration programs has exacerbated the problem. Even if they did report the crime, they may still be denied access to justice if law enforcement officials see them not as a victim of crime, but as a criminal. Customs and Border Protection officials, here we see oftentimes acts of corruption. These are the drug and human smuggling, the money laundering. There's been about 2,000 Customs and Border Patrol Protection officers charged in criminal conduct. 138 have been arrested or indicted since 2004. The Customs and Border Protection officials abuse of migrants that are in custody, and these are common stories that we hear from migrants who have been deported and are cross the line into Mexico and come to our migrant first aid station, where we see many of them who have terrible problems, you can imagine, with their feet in terms of the long treks through the desert, blisters and cuts and abrasions. In terms of Operation Streamline, in 2005, it was initiated by the U.S. government. There's zero tolerance with a multi-agency law enforcement initiative that has been implemented in some of the border counties. Operation Streamline mandates criminal prosecution of all individuals suspecting of crossing the U.S.-Mexico border without authorization, regardless of their criminal or immigration history. Prison sentences are up to 6 months, and they can be imposed for imposed for illegal entry. And illegal entry could be up to 20 years, could yield up to 20 years of imprisonment. So, recommendations that we see from Amnesty International and ACLU has called for an adoption of zero tolerance of abuses, to reform use of force training and policies, to reform use of force training and policies, and to institute strategies to assure that undocumented border crossers have due process protections during detention and deportation, and that they're ensured equitable access to education and health care. So in conclusion, there is an urgent need for the U.S. government to abide by the human rights treaties to which it is a signatory. All immigrants, irrespective of their legal status, have human rights. And the U.S., according to Amnesty International, is failing to ensure these rights. And I thought this statement by George Orwell was quite fitting for this topic. And this is a beautiful picture of our Arizona Sonora border. Thank you very much.
Any immediate questions? Or yes, ma'am.
So you said the desert aid station. Do you work with them, or yes? What organizations do you work with them?
Yeah. I know the folks. I work tangentially with Normal Deaths. This was a binational collaboration between Salud Pública in Mexico and a council in Nogales, Arizona, that we were able to develop the migrant first aid station. It was We got space at their Mexico's equivalent to ICE, and we have been running a migrant first aid station. I'm with the University of Arizona College of Nursing, College of Public Health. We have had students from the Health Sciences Center who volunteer, and they staff the migrant first aid station. A nurse from Nogales, Sonora runs the first aid station, and we have drives to collect health supplies to stock the first aid station. Sadly, 2 weeks ago, we were informed that the Mexico has asked us to leave the property, and we're working with Father Sean and others locally, and hopefully we will. One of our directors recently met with the Board of Health and the Salud Pública, Secretariat de Salud, and we're hoping that we will find another location very quickly.